Today on the Potential Psychology Podcast.
Mess with your job. Change it, you know, on the front end, go, how can this job have more purpose so that I can sit down on Friday and say, I'm proud of my work week because I made a meaningful difference. So like I like telling people, you don't have to put up with the job the way you got it. You know, you can like push the edges and turn it into something that does good.
Welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, psychologist Ellen Jackson, and this is the show in which we explore what it is to be human and how we as humans can fulfill our potential. Hello and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. This is the second part of my two-part conversation with Bea Boccalandro, author of Do Good at Work, How Simple Acts of Social Purpose Drive Success and Wellbeing, and expert in all things finding purpose through work and corporate social responsibility. And if you listened to part one of my conversation with Bea, you will remember that we explored what it means to have purpose and to engage in simple acts of purpose and how doing so helps us physiologically, psychologically, and emotionally. And we're going to jump right back into the second part of that conversation with Bea. She's going to give us some more examples and some ideas for finding purpose in our work.
One thing is, your colleagues are doing this. So there'd be no need for my book if everybody was, but there's no good survey out there that is generalizable to the population. But like from the data I have from different organizations and stuff, probably at least 1 in 10 people have job purpose in your workplace. So one thing you can do is just look around and become aware. And maybe the engineering department is going out there when there's a snowstorm and clearing everybody's cars from snow during, they call it like winter recess or something. They clear everybody's car from snow so that they don't have to, you know, do that at the end of the day, especially, you know, women in high heel shoes. And so maybe you can just join them. And there are also, your employer might have some more formal ways of bringing purpose into your work week. So, you know, there's employee volunteering and those sorts of things. So sometimes it's just joining up what other people are doing or what's already sanctioned out there. The employee resource groups, is that a term that you all use?
Yeah. And I'm thinking there's lots of committees within a lot of organizations or special projects that people can join that might be focused. One of our local organizations, our water authority, I know have a lot of really interesting mini projects that happen that aren't necessarily immediately linked to the greater purpose of the organization, but by virtue of, you know, the cohort who are working there, one of the things that I know has been, and actually I love this story because it's such a cool one. There's a couple of people for different reasons interested in improving accessibility for people, particularly who are vision impaired. And so they have employees there and they also have employees who train seeing eye dogs. So your assistance dog. And one of the things that this organization did recently was actually put in, and I've forgotten what the term was now, I wish I could remember it, but it's basically a toileting space for assistance dogs. So it's a little bit of artificial grass in a particular area of the work location that is treated so that, you know, with the water retaining crystals, whatever it might be. And so individuals with assistance dogs can take them to do what they need to do just there instead, because otherwise in workplaces, they are having to, you know, cross roads, head to local parks, stand out by the traffic on the, you know, where there's a verge. Simple idea that, as far as I'm aware, was an initiative of employees in the workplace who kind of lobbied for it and made it happen. So I'm not sure if I've got all the details of that exactly right, but I read about it. I know one of the individuals there. He was a member of our community leadership program last year. And it's such a cool thing. It's such a simple thing, a little thing, and something that perhaps you wouldn't otherwise think about.
Yes, I love that example. That's beautiful.
I'll have to introduce you to a couple of the people involved when you're out here.
Yeah, I would love that. I would love that.
An Australian example.
Yeah, that's a beautiful example. First of all, one thing I want to tell your listeners is that most people feel terrible because they can't come up with their idea. They're like, I don't know what my Python patroller equivalent is or what my job purposing is. It takes a while. And I think the reason it takes a while is not that there aren't opportunities everywhere, but because of this phenomenon called inattentional blindness, which I'm sure you know what it is. But like for your listeners, it's just like, close your eyes right now and tell me around you how many green items there are. So just count them real quick. All right, now open your eyes. Count how many green items are out there. Okay, you still counting? Make sure you don't miss any. Look for green, look for green, look for green. Okay, now close your eyes. How many yellow items did you see? You'd be lucky to come up with two or three. That's inattentional blindness. So what's happening is you're going into work with what is on your to-do list. You got to review these slides. You got to attend this meeting. You need to clear this whole shelf of everything that's on it and fix the shelf and put everything back on, whatever's on your to-do list. And so you're missing opportunities to contribute all around you because you weren't asked to look for the yellow. You were looking for the green. So you're just looking for the green. So it takes a little bit of shifting your mindset and your attention to start seeing opportunities to job purpose. And what I would suggest so that you find your version that works for you is a couple of times a day, set a timer for like a random time. And if the timer goes off, and you can put it right in your reminder if you're using a smartphone, answer these two questions for yourself. Whatever task I'm doing right now, is there a way to do it in a way that contributes to others or society? So let's say we're both in surf town. So let's say I'm a surf fin designer. I'm literally working on the design of the new surf fin. And the alarm goes off and I'm like, is there a way that I could make this fin so that it is helpful, more helpful to society? And it's like, well, I could use recycled plastic. And that's an idea. Well, maybe there's a way to put a sensor in the fin that relays information to scientists that are trying to save our oceans. So those ideas would have never occurred to you unless you shifted your mindset. The second question to ask is, who was the last person I interacted with and how are they doing? Do I even know how they're doing? So you might have gotten off the phone with a client, or you might have just seen, you know, the receptionist on the way in. And maybe you did notice and it's like, oh, wow, you know, he was coughing. And, you know, I have this natural remedy that, you know, I give to everybody. Maybe I'll just like take it to him and just see how he's doing. So those two questions, there's a longer version of this, but you need to read the book for that. But just asking those two questions two times a day, after a week, you'll start seeing opportunities for job purposing wherever you are. And if you don't, this is an offer that's in my book. You usually have to get to, I don't know, chapter 6 or something to get it. But contact me because I love the hard cases. So I have thus far, there has been no one that has come to me having a hard time. And then after working together for a while, we don't come up with one. So I love the hard cases. So if after doing this for a week, you can't find a feasible way to job purpose, contact me. And you can contact me right on the webpage.
We will put all of that information and of course the links to the book in the show notes. And yes, I both hope you are flooded with contact, but also not, because I'm hoping that our listeners can do this on their own. I'm particularly, what I loved, well, a couple of things I loved about what you just explained, Bea, was that one, there's different ways of doing this depending on whether you're sort of a more task-focused person or a more relationship-focused person. So we're not all the same. So for some people, that connecting with other people, that, you know, we were talking before about those acts of kindness, that's a really meaningful thing, but it's not the way everybody is wired up. So if you are a more task-focused person and then you're able to consider, well, what is it that I'm doing, making, evolving, creating, shaping, you know, what are my tasks, and then how might that play into connecting it to something more meaningful? The other thing I love about this, and it's something that I'm really passionate about, is just the notion of curiosity. Of just even perhaps asking, noticing, looking, yes, seeing what other people are doing. You know, in my mind, I'm kind of thinking, oh, yeah, in a workplace, you know, who just seems to love what they do? Who just has a sense of energy? And perhaps it's not necessarily just innate to who they are. Perhaps it is that there's something about their role and what they're doing day to day that they are getting that sense of meaning from, for whom there is purpose, and that's contributing. So is it a coffee conversation just to say, you know, I noticed that you just seem to love what you do. Why is that? And maybe the person themselves haven't realized that either, but this conversation might help them to trigger it. I don't know, but very much I'm a big fan of, and I think it's attributable to Arthur Ashe, start where you are, use what you have, do what you can. So these don't need to be big, complex things. And sometimes it is just having that awareness and that attention, as you were saying, not being inattentive, you know, having that inattentional blindness, but also just being curious. And perhaps a little bit patient too, if you are one of those people for whom this still feels really hard.
Yeah. And I love the point about curiosity. That's just lovely to notice that about it, which, you know, and of course, if you, the people with curiosity, you know, just things go better, right? The relationships go better, you know, you learn more, all of those things. So that's a really powerful point. And yeah. I find that the people that are like the managers, especially, that are super skeptical about this or just don't feel comfortable trying it, one low-hanging fruit for middle managers is just shift one incentive toward being more charitable and just see how it goes. So in the book, there's the example of Charles Antis. It's a construction company, and he just decided that, oh, and look at this. I actually have one of his cards on video.
There we are.
He just sent me one of these. So for those of you who aren't on video, what I'm holding up is a charitable donation card. And his idea was, because he was very, again, skeptical about it. He just said, well, I'm just going to do one thing. And it's the employee of the month is going to get like a $35, I think, charitable donation card. That's what they're going to be rewarded for. It used to be, you know, like McDonald's or something, you know, some commercial fast food or something like that. And I'm just going to see how it goes. And this was years and years ago. He never went back, because what happened was he would give the employee of the month a charitable donation card. And then the next staff meeting, he would ask them, do you want to share what you did with your donation? And they always did, because they were usually passionate about what they were supporting. So they said, yeah, you know, I had this coach in high school, and he was there for me when my parents weren't able to really be there because of their own issues. And I wouldn't have graduated from high school because of him. So my donation went to, you know, the nonprofit that supports sports coaches in, you know, their training or development or whatever their issue was there. And so what he said was that it brought in all this realness and all this, like, understanding each other better, and also just this tilt towards contribution into the conversation at the workplace. And so he never went back. So if nothing else, like, you can just start rewarding people with something charitable, or, you know, you buy the product that is put out by the nonprofit that supports the nonprofit instead of buying, and then just see how that goes, you know, see, because you're not doing anything so radical that there's going to be some huge backlash or anything. You're just kind of seeing how it goes. And by the way, the reason Charles Antis is in the book is because even though the charitable cards were one of the very early steps that he did to really bring purpose to his organization, the whole organization is exemplary in that regard now. So it was a first step, but, you know, he just kept going and is still going. So every month, you know, that organization is probably a brighter light to the local community than it was the month before. But it all just started with experimenting with that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because that notion of just test and learn, just be prepared to try one small thing, and then linking back to that reflection, you know, how did it go? What worked? What didn't work? And the other thing I love about that example is that sharing amongst then the staff group, because I have had a similar experience with a staff group, and we were talking about some of the principles of positive psychology for getting, you know, more out of your work and feeling more engaged and staying well. So I think it was real, almost a kind of a stress management lens. And I'm not even sure quite how it arose now, but one of the staff group, and this was, you know, probably 30 people, were packed into a really close, the vets. And so they'd come in on their kind of, you know, lunch break, but they all go out, and they're actually specialists in equine veterinary. So they go off and, you know, deal with horses and things like that. So we were packed into this tiny room having this kind of conversation, which is probably a little unusual. And however we came to it, one of the younger women there shared that she has neighbours who are older, elderly, and she cooks them a baked lunch, like a roast lunch, once a week or once a month or something or other like that. She just noticed that perhaps, you know, they didn't have family. I can't remember the exact details of the story, but and she's got small children herself. And so she sort of brought this in. So it's become like this kind of proxy family. And she said, it's not something I ever talk about. I just do it. We do it because it's the right thing to do. You know, it feels right for our family. We want to be able to do this, but we never talk about it. And what was amazing was the response in that room of all of her colleagues who were kind of like, wow, that's an incredible thing to do. And she was sort of downplaying it. She goes, it's not a big deal, you know, it's just what we do. I'm going to cook lunch anyway. It's, you know, but for them, it was sort of this appreciation of something about somebody who had, you know, this is clearly meaningful to them and they didn't know. And then it really triggered a whole conversation in that workplace about what is it other people are already doing, or perhaps what is it I could do now that might be one of these simple things that is going to bring a sense of meaning and purpose. But just that visceral response, you know, of everybody in the room who just went, oh, that's amazing. That's an incredible story. And the curiosity that then people had, not only to learn a little more about what, why, and how for her, but then the curiosity about, well, you know, what could we do as well?
Right.
So, yeah, just, yes. You know, sometimes there is stuff, as you say, just already out there. And that process of, and I think we need to be able to create the what we call a psychologically safe environment for people to be able to share those with their colleagues. But if we can, and if it is a simple, you know, you're having your team meeting, yeah, share where you chose to give your donation or share something that you've done that was meaningful to you, there's a huge amount of power in connection, in positive emotion, and the flow-on effect then to engagement, productivity, and all of that from a workplace, but well-being for individuals, mental health benefits, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, no, that's such a great story. And it's, psychologists have called that elevation, when you witness someone doing, you know, something like super pro-social, and they call it elevation because, I mean, literally it feels like a tiny bit like falling in love, right? Like you're like, oh, wow, it's awe. It's basically a form of awe. And also, you know, in the whole mindset world, there's lots of evidence that the outward mindset, the one that's focused on others rather than ourselves versus the inward mindset, is better for organizations. So what that woman did was bring elevation to everybody and then shift everybody's mindset toward the outward mindset. And so, like, as a culture shift tool, not that it was done deliberately as in a way, it really improves the culture. And there's research done in Madrid at a workplace where they found that when someone receives a charitable act of some form, that they go on to produce three times more charitable acts than they would otherwise. So if some of those people in the room said, were inspired and then just did something nice for someone else, now all of a sudden you have this culture of, essentially this culture of giving, which is one of the things that is just stunning about Charles Antes' company, is that whatever meeting you go into, whatever event, whatever conversation you have with an Antis employee, you sense that they're part of a team. They're supporting others. Others are supporting them. I mean, you might be talking to some, I might be talking to someone, you know, via Zoom or something, and I see one of their colleagues come over and bring them a cup of tea. Because knowing that apparently it was their tea time and I was taking it up. So I knew it, and, you know, and he explained it to me. He's like, oh, yeah, I normally have tea right now, but I didn't want to cut you off. So this colleague brought it. And so it can really support a beneficial culture, a positive culture in the workplace.
It's fairly simple stuff. You know, I think as a workplace psychologist who is, you know, over the years, I am seeing a shift in workplaces to starting to perhaps understand, certainly, and the Charles Antis one is a prime example of perhaps some cynicism to begin with, but just testing learning and letting it kind of, you almost evolve from that. But, you know, when you think back to the so many days of we need to change the culture, where's a kind of culture change model? And you bring in the external consultants and there's this big, complex, expensive rigmarole that requires people to do all of this complex stuff, and yet so often we know, certainly in terms of culture change, it fails. I mean, more often than not, it fails. And so starting to look at some of these much smaller, seemingly much smaller, at least initially, but ultimately far more impactful things that are about connecting with human, being human. I think that's what I love about it, is that it's actually reminding us that just because we are in a workplace, in an organization, in a job, we are human beings. And the more that we can be the best version of ourselves as human beings and understand what that is and be proactive about it in really simple ways, then, you know, all the other good stuff kind of flows from there, doesn't it?
That's a beautiful explanation of it. Yeah, that is what it boils down to, isn't it?
That's why I do what I do, B. That's my meaning and purpose. I'm trying to connect human beings with work and their work experience.
Well, and, you know, so job purposing really is our birthright. Because if you go back 10,000 years to our prehistoric forebears, they didn't hunt game for their own dinner table, but for the tribal feast. They didn't pick the amount of berries that they were going to consume. They would continue gathering berries until there was enough to feed their neighbors. Work was inherently job purposed. There wasn't this idea that you work for your own 2.4 kids and that for your own bonus and for your own career. That all came much later. So we're at a visceral level. This is what feels most natural to us, is work that is always contributing, or not always, it doesn't have to be always, I want to make that clear, but it's like that is on a weekly basis contributing to something bigger, maybe.
It has to be enough of that.
Yeah, that feels very natural to us at a visceral level. This isn't like just thinking, oh, this would be good. It sits well with us. And what I find is fascinating is that anthropologists are now discovering that work felt so natural and so enjoyable to basically pre-agricultural societies that they don't even have a word for work. So work and playing with your toddler children or just shooting the breeze with your neighbors is all the same thing. It's all leisure. There's no word for work. Everything is leisure. There's no part of life that is toil. It was all equally enjoyable. And that doesn't mean there isn't hardship, because, I mean, we do things for enjoyment. I mean, I surf for enjoyment. And I mean, there are days that are not fun at all. I can't catch the wave and falling left and right or whatever. Like, it doesn't mean that there isn't struggle and that there isn't exhaustion and that there isn't frustration. Because we choose to do things that meet all those criteria all the time. You know, we climb mountains and we garden and, you know, like weeding for hours and then you know, some deer comes and eats all our stuff. So it's not that it isn't difficult, but it's that it calls you in a way that feels right, that you're not thinking the entire time, I'd rather be doing something else. So really, for our prehistoric ancestors, that was normal. Like, work felt like that all the time. And one of the key reasons it did is because it was always for the whole tribe. Like, there was no such thing as like building your own hut and like letting everybody else figure it out for themselves, or allow someone else to not have a hut. Like, that just wasn't a concept.
I wonder too, this is getting, you know, quite maybe philosophical, I'm not sure, but I know I've heard experts discuss the parallels between some of the rising mental ill health concerns and some of the challenges we're facing now, and increase in things like consumerism and individualism. And, you know, there seems to be, again, we don't necessarily know the mechanics of it, but there certainly seems to be correlations there between people feeling disconnected, perhaps not having that sense of, you know, the stuff that we have evolved around us socioculturally, that seems to focus very much on this individual notion. And maybe it is partly a disconnect from this sense of meaning and purpose that we've got so focused on success and happiness. And I use that in that kind of more superficial manner, not contentment, the real happiness that we're talking about in a post-psych sense, but that superficial happiness. And that as we've kind of gone further and further down that path, disconnected from some of this stuff that is really meaningful for us, that our ancestors may not have known cognitively, but certainly experienced day to day. And whether there's all sorts of other pieces, you know, we've talked about the workplace and workplace engagement and productivity, but, you know, mental health and people's sense of well-being and, you know, maybe even reducing conflict. I don't know. Yeah. You can see I'm inspired by all of this stuff and the possibilities that it might be bringing forth.
Yeah, no, and there's a lot to learn still, right? Like, we know a lot, but I do think, like, for example, that balance between focusing on self and focusing on others. So I, there any hard evidence, this is just an opinion, but I think it's not a good sign that you walk into a bookstore and there's, you know, the self section, and it has, a, you know, the
self-improvement, self-help, whatever it might be.
Self-improvement section, yeah. Right? Like, and it's like self-care and I don't know. There's so much about self-care. And I'm like, well, where's the other? Where's the other care? Like that. And so I guess I'm siding in on the side that I do think maybe we're trying to solve too many things by focusing on ourselves. And even saying that, I feel, especially as a woman, awkward, because it's like there's no doubt that it's important, you know, to have boundaries and to make sure you get enough sleep and enough exercise and all those things. But I also notice that a lot of people, like, when emotionally they get in a difficult place, their solution is to go get a manicure. And I'm thinking, I don't think that's gonna help.
I could talk endlessly about self-care and what it actually really means. Versus, okay, you know, it's good. Not Netflix and bubble baths.
And I need to hear that, because it's kind of a, yeah. Yeah, so I'm like, you know what? You'd be better off just volunteering at the soup kitchen. I think spending that 45 minutes doing that would probably serve you better. But I don't know. I don't know when it's one and when it's the other. Like,
yeah, and look, I think there's a bit of cognitive, whether you want to call it a cognitive reframing, I think there's a little bit of how we think about those things. So I think one of the challenges, and again, you know, I'd say the same thing as a woman and as a working mother, there's a lot about putting yourself last. You know, there's a lot about how we continue to do that, that you have to fill your own cup. And I think that's absolutely true. But it is, I think what we're talking about is what you're filling your cup with and why. So, you know, some of these things that we might seem to think are easy, so sometimes you need that, you know, sometimes you need a manicure, sometimes you need to just sit and watch Netflix. But other times we need to understand that we might benefit more from volunteering or connecting with other people or doing something for our community, not because it's for them, but because it's also for us. I think that's the thing that perhaps we miss sometimes with that, that if I'm doing stuff for others, it's for them, it's not for me. But knowing everything that we know from the conversation we've had and all of that research you've been able to bring forth is that, you know, you're actually doing good for you in the doing of good for others. That's where that well-being piece comes in, isn't it? So, you know, being able to kind of know that and remind yourself and then make choices accordingly as to what's the best activity for me right now.
Yeah, I love that distinction you just made, that it's not mutually exclusive. Like, it's not, there's a range, and on one side is like doing things for me, and the other end it's doing things for others. That's not the way this breaks down.
It's not binary.
No,
like,
it's not
binary. Like so much about being human, it's not binary.
Yeah, and you know, to that point, there's this research done on these Canadians that win, I don't forget what the name of the award is, but it's the award for being like the incredible giving citizen. So these are people that like open their house up to Indigenous individuals that are severely handicapped and that start new nonprofits. And so they win awards for that. And they went in and they were looking at how much do they neglect their own careers and their own ambitions. And what they found was that, yes, they're off the charts, and that's why they win the awards for all the other oriented stuff, but they're also off the charts for their ambitions and their success in their own success. So in how much power they have, how much they climb up, how many promotions they get, they're just, life is just bigger all around for them, and they don't really see that tension apparently between, you know, the other and the self, which is probably not really there. It's kind of a construct of our minds. Yeah.
We've wandered into all sorts of interesting territory here. I want to, before I let you go, I would like to ask you a little bit, because you mentioned earlier that you've, in your day job, work in the CSR or corporate social responsibility space, so to speak. How does that stuff, it's about, I suppose, drawing a clear line here, perhaps from your perspective, how that relates. So I know historically, or my understanding, certainly historically, I'm sure there's still a view out there that, you know, organizations operate in the CSR space as a form of PR, positive spin, whatever, you know, that might be the cynical view. How do you connect it up, these two elements of purpose and what is meaningful to individuals, and then what organizations, and even perhaps defining what CSR is, what some of the work that you do is, so that everyone's clear?
Yeah, so the definition of corporate social responsibility that I think is the most helpful is that it's really anything a company does that is meant to be a meaningful contribution to help with a societal issue that it doesn't have to do. So if it has to do because it's regulatory, or if it has to do because there's so much pressure, for example, that's probably not corporate social responsibility any longer. So if you think about it, it's really the organizational equivalent of job purposing, because it's, if you're not job purposing, you're just accepting the job exactly as you got it, and you're not pushing the boundaries to do any more good than the job inherently already does for anybody. And when you job purpose, you push the boundaries and you're like, oh, well, I could be saving the oceans a little bit more, or I could be more inclusive, you know, the way I run meetings, or however it is that you job purpose. So corporate social responsibility is really that same concept applied to the entire company. And my day job of doing that, really my favorite part is getting that to trickle all the way across the organization in terms of the team members. So then they really kind of merge, because if your employer is attentive to this and attending to it, then your job will be more inherently job purposed. And there are organizations that you can work for where they've already done this work, and your job is much more likely, even if you don't job purpose it, even if you just take it the way it is, that at the end of the day, you're helping with a societal cause. And, you know, probably the most well-known one is Patagonia. Is Patagonia a known brand in Australia?
Increasingly so, but perhaps share the story so that everyone's, you know.
Yeah, so Patagonia, they make outdoor clothing. They've been around for, I don't know, maybe 40 years or something. But what's interesting about Patagonia is that they have never put the idea of making money above the idea of protecting the environment or saving the environment, frankly. So the reason organic cotton exists is probably because of Patagonia, because it was seen as something kind of impossible to make commercially work. But Patagonia was like, we cannot live with ourselves making a t-shirt that is putting all these pesticides into the environment. So they worked with the textile companies and managed to put organic cotton out there as a raw material that anybody can use now. Very early on, when, you know, they hired people because they were, when they were, you know, early in their careers, it's just the kind of company they were. They started having kids. What to do about childcare? They're one of the very first companies that said, well, obviously we got to help them solve this, so we'll have on-site childcare. So all along, they have been making decisions like that. There's a great book called Let My People Surf by the founder of Patagonia, Yvon Chouinard. And so there's no question that if you manage to get a job at Patagonia, which, by the way, is almost impossible. It's harder.
I expect no one leaves.
To get a job at Patagonia than to get into Harvard. So it's incredibly hard to get a job there. But if you manage to get a job there, they have done this corporate social responsibility work, and it has trickled all the way down. So if you are selling clothes at a Patagonia retail store, when someone enters that door and you're chit-chatting, you're not chit-chatting about the weather. You're chit-chatting about how there are these wildlife corridors for these mountain goats that are threatened by this development. And would you like to sign a petition to stop this development so that these animals will have access to the full corridor? So your job, you don't have the job purpose. Although what's crazy about Patagonia is that they're always encouraging this. It's like, how can we do better? And people are always pushing their jobs to do better. So corporate social responsibility and job purposing in the end really end up being the same thing. It ends up being that every decision that is made, you know, and it is extreme, every decision that is made is with looking at a lens of like, how can we make this better for the world? Like, at least consider that. Not that you always have to choose that way. Sometimes it's infeasible. You can't afford to do that. But that mindset is there for every decision. One of the reasons, one of the very personal reasons I went for the job purposing and wrote Do Good at Work was frankly because after 10 years of working on the corporate social responsibility space, even though I love my job and I love my colleagues, it was moving too slowly. So I thought, well, we need to start a revolution from, you know, within the belly of the beast to kind of help this along. Because otherwise, basically, companies are going to not look much better in a generation. So yeah, so they all kind of relate.
Yeah, well, that's what I was just thinking as you were speaking. So we've got this kind of job purposing notion at the individual level, and is CSR doing it at the collective level? So it's kind of the scalable version of it. And that it's not an either or, it's an and both that has a kind of positive reciprocal relationship. So if you've got your organization really investing in this and doing it for the right reasons because it's meaningful, that can't help but trickle down in that kind of elevation, perhaps, manner that we're speaking of before. You know, it's just got to be meaningful. It attracts the sort of people, therefore, to that organization who want that. You know, they bring their enthusiasm, they probably bring their ideas, they probably bring their courage and willingness to push boundaries. And so you've got the bottom down, you know, pushing up whilst you've got the top pushing down, if I've got that right.
Yeah. But I think that's right.
I love the idea that, you know, because what you're doing then is having worked at that top down approach and seeing the benefits to the individuals. Now there's an opportunity for this wonderful education and proactive piece at that bottom up level to start to say, you know, we can't wait for the leaders, for the organizations, for the decision makers to do everything in this space. We need you as individuals to understand why this is really important, not just for the environment, for causes, for the globe, you know, for things that are important to you, but for you as a person. You know, why is this important right. to you in terms of your mental health, your well-being, at what kind of enthusiasm ideas you go home to your family with at the end of the day, all of that positive flow and effect that we get from doing good work in the sense of doing work that is good, but also doing it well. So it may not have been an intention, but now looking at it with that kind of perspective, perhaps there's just perfect strategy. Makes perfect sense to do the top and now start at the bottom.
Ooh, yeah, no, I'm glad it makes sense. Yeah, and I think it's beginning to all make more sense to everybody. I mean, one of the interesting things about all of this work is that, again, I think because we're naturally inclined to want our lives to be meaningful, there's so much energy in this space of having this be true in our jobs, even if they are corporate jobs. And it's coming from all sorts of different directions. And so there are many more terms than the ones I just mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, Ashoka was like, oh, you know, there's the social entrepreneurs with an I, which is the person who inside the organization starts agitating things to be more positive, right? And then there's the employee activist who is trying to get companies to, you know, not sell to defense companies. And then there's the investor activist who is trying to make sure that their investments don't have a huge carbon footprint. Mm. So I think like it is this very human response to want to make our organizations to be more part of the solution. And it's showing up everywhere.
Mm.
So there's a zillion terms.
Mm.
There's ESG that comes from the investors. And then there's also like conscious capitalism, there's sustainability, there's, so anyway, it's really pretty beautiful because it's messy, but it's just so beautiful.
I love that. I love that it's the beauty of the messy complexity that's there that I know not everybody's comfortable with, but I, you know, it's just the nature of the world that we live in. The terms that came to mind, you know, we talk about for-purpose organizations, even not-for-profits to some extent, you know, there's our community-based organizations, social enterprise, you're right. And it's coming at it from lots of different angles. And then I can overlay that with what we see from, you know, the whole field of wellbeing science. I'm going to sort of move on from calling it positive psychology, wellbeing science, but the understanding of where these pieces fit in terms of individual experience, but also community experience. And yeah, look, it's complex, but in a wonderfully messy and evolving way, evolving in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. And yeah, I mean, there is like some entropic quality to it, but like on the whole, and you know, and sometimes like the forces like go against each other, but like on the whole, I think it's just elevating everything.
Mm. I think that's a perfect way for us to finish off, B. I really appreciate your time. It's been a fabulous conversation, and thank you so much for everything that you have shared with us today at a personal experience level, at a research data level, at a practical and organizational experience level. It's been a real joy. And we will put a lot of the references, the books, the everything that you've mentioned, but most particularly a link to your book, which is Do Good at Work, How Simple Acts of Social Purpose Drive Success and Wellbeing. I will put it up there for people who are watching on video. I actually listened to it the first time around. So I've been through a couple of times now, and I did it first on audiobook form when I had a long drive and was captivated by it. It kept me entertained and enthused and thinking for the whole of a long drive, and have read it again now in book form. So it is available, and we will put the link to that in the show notes along with everything else, and also how to contact B, because as she generously offered earlier, if you're still really struggling after listening to our long and in-depth conversation about this, yeah, opportunity to perhaps thrash that out a little bit and say, and we will share your work that you do. I suspect you're already pretty busy, but we will share the CSR work that you do as well, and let people know how to make contact with you if that's something that they'd like to talk about at an organizational level as well.
That sounds great. And people, you know, you can contact me with success stories too.
Yes. Well, that's another thing too. There could be a whole series of books in this. There's certainly lots of case studies that you can use through presentations and speaking and other ways of sharing some of this stuff, because it is sometimes those success stories, the real stories that people find so engaging and meaningful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bea, thank you so much for everything. You are coming to Australia for an event that I'm running in my day job when I'm not being a podcaster. And we're really excited about that. And I'll put details of that. It's a corporate citizenship event. We're calling it. It's here in Ballarat, and you will be our keynote speaker. We're very excited. You're also perhaps doing some other speaking gigs while you're here too. So we'll put all the details of that in the show notes for people as well, if they'd like to come and even perhaps meet you after your speaking engagements and say hi. Thank you again.
Oh, this has been so fun, Ellen. And I know that labels me as a nerd, but it's such a great conversation with you. Thank you for having me. And I look forward to seeing you in person.
Yeah, very soon. Thank you, Bea. Thank you so much for listening in and sharing that conversation with Bea Boccolandro with me, both parts of it. I hope it's given you some ideas and inspiration for engaging in simple acts of purpose in your life and in your work. And if you're keen to explore more on this topic or to take Bea up on her offer to help, we've included all of the references and studies and books that Bea mentioned, as well, of course, as a link to her book, Do Good at Work, How Simple Acts of Purpose Drive Success and Wellbeing, and where to find her. It's all in the show notes for today's episode. There's also a transcript of our conversation. It's all at potential.com.au/podcast, where you will also find all of our past podcast episodes. There's 5 years of them as of this month. And if you want to get social, we're on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook, and you can watch the video of each episode of the Potential Psychology Podcast on YouTube. Just search Potential Psychology. And if you're interested in seeing Bea speak live, and it will be very cool, and indeed attending a workshop on job purposing with her, she's going to be doing both of those things here in Ballarat, Victoria, on the 23rd of March, 2023. She is the keynote speaker for the Committee for Ballarat's Corporate Citizenship Conference. It's a big little event that the team at Committee and I are bringing to life. It's the 23rd of March, 2023, with Bea Boccolandro. To find out more, go to committeeforballarat.com or message me and I'll send you all the details. As always, a big thanks to my team, Jay, Sherry and Andy, for their work getting this week's episode to your ears. Have a great week, engage in some simple acts of purpose, and do what you can to fulfill your potential.